Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Wednesday, November 1st. We have Tom Lamb and Ira Harris. Tom is over two decades experience in the realm of economics and finance with expertise ranging covering the global economy, deciphering financial markets, including macro forecasting, advising on investment strategy. He commenced his career in New York at the outset with a large money center bank and then a hedge fund. Thereafter, while in Singapore, where he's based currently, he worked at two financial institutions and later joined academia. He's been consistently ranked among the top five most accurate economists in the world forecasting the U.S. economy overall, placed third last published by the Bloomberg rankings of top forecasters. And during the global financial crisis, he was also acknowledged as the second best U.S. forecaster worldwide. He's been widely publicized as Wall Street's most prophetic economist. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Well, thanks, Richard.
Thanks Richard. Thanks, Tom, for being on. Should be great.
Great. I thought, Tom, we'd begin with your macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Ira. Sure. Thanks for the colorful introduction. I guess broadly, one way to frame the current macro debate, I guess, is to consider maybe five intermingling angles. One, global central bank policy, led by the Fed, of course. And then two, the trend or underlying inflation backdrop, because that's still above central banks' targets, broadly. Three, the degree of divergence or convergence in global growth, with emphasis on the US, China, perhaps to a lesser extent, the Eurozone. The fourth one is what I call the rest, which stands, I guess, for roughly exogenous shocks, which encompass geopolitical developments, given what's happening, and then that links back to oil prices, commodity prices in general. And perhaps also the lingering COVID effects. There are some long-term demographics impact on that front, which people don't talk about because it's still more or less ongoing. And then finally, the financial market risk interactions with the aforementioned factors, right? So I think this is how I would, think about the current macro environment, and trying to go into each one and trying to disentangle it. But I think in general, one way to think about this is really that you need to go beyond the headlines, into the nooks and crannies, to get a better sense. Just by looking at the headlines, I think you might miss some of the more insightful aspects to the current debate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll be happy to delve into any of these topics.
Yeah, those are great points. Your thoughts, Ira, in which areas you'd like to delve into more?
I'm prepared to go everywhere where Tom's at. There are so many things going on in the world, as I like to say, and I said this would be a very volatile world year, that there were so many piles of dry tinder that, in to paraphrase Mao, takes a single spark to start a prairie fire. There's a lot of prairie fires out there, and some that we haven't even thought about that are now ramping up on the scene. So, yeah, we could go all those places in the time we have allotted. So,
mm-hmm.
tough job for you, Richard. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Just wondering, today is Fed Day. For the Federal Reserve comments and statements. Any thoughts on today? What could happen or what could be stated, Tom?
Yeah, well, I think, clearly the decision or the outcome, that's pretty much established. I mean, the markets are pricing in more than 95% for the Fed to remain unchanged. So that's not the focus, clearly. So the emphasis is to a lesser extent, on the statement, but more so on the presser, Jay Powell's, press conference. I guess on the statement, I would look for the key guidance being that the extent of additional policy firming, I think that sentence in itself gives the Fed the option to hike at least at the next meeting, assuming that the data compels and the macro environment allows. And as far as the press conference, I mean, that is always the wild card. Right. But my sense is that Powell, as he has always been, he has been very cautious, when it comes to dealing with the markets. He never likes to surprise the market. But having said that, I think that financial market conditions at this juncture, it's not that tight. You know, I mean, it is maybe around one standard deviation above average or thereabouts. So things have improved somewhat more so in recent days. So there's room, I think, for Powell to try to tighten market conditions somewhat, just to re-emphasize or rehash the point that the option to tighten remains on the table. I think the bigger question for the Fed, per se, is really whether or not is the Fed's intention, do they intend to nudge up risk premiums, either by staying high for longer, right? Even without hiking, let's say, but just keeping it there, just to push risk premiums higher, in order to ensure that the disinflationary path is proceeding based on what they deem as appropriate. I think that's the key thing, because if that's the case, and then if their intention is to nudge up the risk premiums, I think that that would imply that you would probably see a continuation of the positive correlation between equities and bonds, right? Because that's key, because we have quite a number of years of a negative correlation between bond prices and equity prices. That would obviously provide the hedge, bonds providing a hedge for equities. But if the Fed intends to nudge up risk premiums, term premiums, that would imply that there'll be a positive correlation between equity and bonds would no longer provide that much of a hedge. And as a result, the market environment perhaps might be a riskier in general. And that would have to reset, going forward. But I think my baseline, in general, is still for the Fed. Perhaps with one more hike. I think that given looking at what market pricing is, I think they can even afford to push out the hike and just remain on hold at least for the first part of through the first part of next year. I think that there is room for the Fed to cut next year. The window here, if I'm looking at the market pricing at this juncture, I mean, June through September is a good window for them to do something. And it seems like, even if you look at some of the data, you drill down into it, I think that the forecast, at least my forecast, imply that we could get higher unemployment, weaker growth, inflation rolling down. And all that, I think, sets the tone for the Fed to do something, perhaps in the second half of next year, changing direction, if that's true. So in other words, ideally, the Fed wants to maintain interest rates, if not deliver one more hike. But I think the markets are not signaling that at this juncture, and I think the markets are more or less right. And I think that more so, I think we are moving, you know, toward the direction whereby when is the first, I guess, a shift in Fed policy, you know, transitioning from, I guess, a plateau in rates to an eventual rate cut. I think that's where the debate is.
Interesting points and views. Your thoughts, Ira, on that scenario?
Well, while Tom was speaking, I just got an email, and the release of the suggestions from TBAC, the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, which I personally have no faith in because they're all traders. So what they get to sit there and give their input, which they know their positions. So what they suggest, and it's coming off an article written from Bloomberg by this brilliant, I think, Fed reporter, Alexandra Harris. And it said the committee, I'll just read the one little bullet point. The committee said in a letter to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen that it supported meaningful deviation from the historical recommendation for 15 to 20% T-bill as the makeup of the Treasury's offerings. So meaningful deviation, and we saw an immediate move in the curves actually inverted to 210 as it should have. So that's their recommendation because it's playing into the Fed. The Fed wants to drain the RRP. So if the Treasury comes with more T-bill offerings, and again, meaningful deviation. So they're going to try to prevent what Tom talked about. They don't want to put too much more pressure on term and what's going on in the coupon end of the market, because I think it's starting to frighten them a little bit, because there's a lot of exposure out there. And as we've talked about several times, Richard, in previous podcasts, we talked about it with Mark Faber, and then certainly with Joseph Wang, so both of them last week. And what we've seen, of course, is a rarity in the Treasury markets, which we've seen a very violent bear steepener take place, especially on the 210. And that, to me, is more in reference to what's going on with the fiscal portion of the U.S. situation. And again, I will go back to cite the article that was published at the St. Louis Fed site by Charles Calamaris on fiscal dominance, because I think it's fiscal dominance and the anticipation of it by certain people in the bond markets that this is a very serious problem for the United States. You know, and I've, Tom, we've never talked about this, but I've, about a year and a half ago, I started warning people that once the cost of financing the deficit exceeds the defense part of the U.S. budget, we are in a very difficult political situation. And we're there. I don't care what the numbers are there. So the Treasury is very aware of this too, and they're going to try to front load this, meaning more T-bills. Why? Because they're hoping to drain the RRP, because the money will come out of there and go into T-bills in the Fed, and then the Fed will be able to go to its next stance. But they are going to have to thread a needle here. And one area where I push back against everybody is I think that Powell has some very political, there's a lot of political dissonance on the Fed, because Biden has four governors that he's appointed. Now, these have all been vetted by, I would say, Leo Brainerd et al. And they're all labor economists. Not that I have anything against labor economists, but they have a history, if you read that, and I've gone through their research, of being very dovish on allowing inflation and wages to take place as a good thing, because it leads, whether it leads to inflation or not, we don't know. You know, I think that the Fed model was flawed. The Phillips curve really failed. And I believe this since I've been in graduate school back in the 70s, that the Phillips curve was flawed because it didn't have an international element to it. It only looked at things domestically. And as capital became more global, it put a lot of downward pressure on U.S. wages. It wasn't what the Fed was doing. It was, you had, especially after, well, in 78, 79, 80, when Deng Xiaoping takes over China and sets into motion everything that, as he said, whatever the two, what was it, the two whatevers of Mao were being pushed to the side, and he was becoming a pragmatic capitalist, right? Practice is the sole criterion for judging truth and to see the way things come out. But we had all these workers come into the global workforce. And then, of course, once the Berlin Wall falls, more. So there was huge global pressure on wages because of capital flowing freely, and capital was rewarded, and wages in the U.S. were punished, which we see the politics now. Well, that's going to be changing, of course. And yes, will wages be more inflationary? Yes. If I go and I look at the new policy that was put forth by National Security Advisor with the new industrial policy back in April, and again, a small yard with a high fence, but as we, I hate this phrase, but I don't have a better one, as we deglobalize, there will be upward wage pressure in the United States. We see it now. We see it, and we see the masterful, Sean Fain, the head of the UAW, the United Auto Workers, was brilliant in the way he orchestrated that strike and the way he was moving it around to, and he got what he wanted. But so I think that Powell has a severe problem at the Fed, especially we're coming into a presidential election. He's got four governors. And I would remind people that it's only the governors, not the regional presidents, who vote on it. And I'd like to hear your comments on the interest on reserves, which we're seeing changes. We saw Switzerland this week change. We saw the ECB change in July. So what is going to be, and they have the power to do that without the regional presidents. And I think that's giving Powell severe, as the Italians would say, agita. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, well, I think that, the comedy within the FOMC, so to speak, you know, I think it will be tested as you get into next year. Particularly, you know, if the economic backdrop starts to turn, right? Mm-hmm. But you're right in terms of when you're thinking about the potential, dichotomy or divergence in views. I think you will see more of that as you get into next year. But in the whole scheme of things, I think notwithstanding the differing postures from the governors and the Fed presidents, but I think that if you look at the FOMC lineup this year and next year, I think if you do a simple reckoning of what their current views are, I think that you could, I guess, argue that I think it's pretty much unchanged as far as the degree of hawkishness or dovishness, in terms of the lineup. I mean, you have, like I said, notwithstanding the governors that are, inclined more on the dovish side. I mean, that's no doubt, like what you said earlier with the nominations and whatnot. But having said that, I think that the entire FOMC lineup between this year and this year and next year, I don't think it's going to be particularly different. I mean, you have, for instance, Goolsbee is going to rotate out Fed President Chicago, right? But you have Bostic rotating in, right? You have maybe a Kashkari is a hawk or somewhat a fickle, but he's a hawk now. But he rotates out, but Mester rotates in. Right, she's hawkish. So you have like maybe Harker rotates out, Daly rotates in. So I don't think, you know, the FOMC lineup per se is going to change all that much. So I think that the broad thrust here is really that what happens to the macro economy. If the macro economy softens, as I would expect it, as you go into next year, and part of it is associated with the tighter financial conditions that we are seeing now. I mean, incrementally, I think financial conditions are probably going to subtract maybe between 2/10 to about 7/10 on future GDP growth. So growth a year from now, you know, could be on average subtract, could on average subtract about 5/10 at least, given where it is now. So if the Fed maintains rates where they are through, let's say, the first part of next year, that's going to continue to crimp growth further. So that's one thing. And then on top of that, the fiscal situation, right? I mean, fiscal policy, it is maybe it's subtracting slightly from growth of about neutral now, but as you get into next year, there'll be incremental drag on that. That's going to expand further, maybe 5/6 on growth on the fiscal side. If the growth backdrop weakens, which I expect, that should push up the unemployment rate. And like I said, I mean, there is this intense debate that goes on between the guys at the Fed and on the one hand, and you have Blanchard and Summers on the other hand, right? And the debate seems to favor the Fed at this juncture, with job openings coming down quite a fair bit and the unemployment rate seems to be pretty sticky. But I think that there are reasons to believe that as this trend continues, and if you look back to history, the unemployment rate usually goes up, right? And I do expect the unemployment to go up next year, maybe closer to about 4.5% from less than 4 now. And then in that setting, I think that the disinflationary path should continue. And you're right. I mean, the Phillips curve, it's an esoteric concept. It's not entirely, stable. There are arguments on the one hand, like you mentioned, that the global aspects to it might dilute some of the Phillips curve coefficients. I personally like to use the longer term and shorter term aspects of looking at inflation rather than just the Phillips curve. And in fact, a simple way to really put a finger on it is to get a sense of what trend inflation is, because the Phillips curve, obviously, that aspect of it is a response to the cyclical aspect of inflation, right? So as long as trend inflation remains high or higher, actual inflation will remain sticky. But if trend inflation continues to roll down, which I think trend inflation should continue to roll down. I mean, now it's probably in the 3-5% range, is above the Fed's comfort zone, but I think it should continue to improve. Part of it is, like I said, helped by the macro backdrop. Then I think actual inflation should continue to improve. I mean, core PC inflation this year maybe would end the year, slightly less than 4, maybe around 3.5 or thereabouts. Maybe next year, closer to 2.5 or thereabouts. This is 4Q over 4Q, so to speak, right? And I think, all that coalesce, I think all those factors coalesce should be sufficient for the Fed to consider, their first rate cut, and I think the wild card here, comes back to the fact that will financial market conditions tighten, Because ultimately, you know, if financial market conditions tighten, you say because of the risk of the higher correlation between, you know, equities and bonds, or maybe because of the higher rates impacting the different segments of the market, or maybe because of the tighter financial conditions from bank, you know, pulling back on bank lending. I mean, all that, you know, if they continue to squeeze growth and continue to strain financial conditions, I think the Fed normally will respond to that. You know, especially if all the you know, macro factors are moving in the right direction. So that's my sense of how things you know, could pan out.
Yeah, and if we take a look at the in Japan, the Bank of Japan, Central Bank, any thoughts there, and in particular on the movement of the yen in recent months and in the near future, any thoughts on that, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, that's bizarre. I mean, the Bank of Japan, one of the major central banks, and one of the you know, I guess challenges is the communication aspects. I mean, they have always communicated poorly, and that it's always been a bizarre aspect of it. I mean, being a major central bank, in fact, they have a tendency to move market even more than usual, add to the volatility, and like I said, add to the rise in the risk premiums. So I think that is, you know, always an issue. And despite all that, I think that I think the other element of it is the co-mingling with the fiscal policy. I mean, recently, I think the administration, you know, unveiled a one-time tax cut next year, right? That's going to complicate matters. In terms of how the BOJ is going to address yield curve control, I mean, even the announcement, you know, in prior months, right, in terms of adding more flexibility and using the 1%, you know, cap, and giving the range as a softer range as opposed to a hard cap, right? I mean, all that potentially adds to the volatility. I mean, one of the issues that I've been told, you know, when I speak to some of the JGB traders, has been liquidity has been a major issue in the JGB market, right? And they're not helping out. So, and with that, the dollar yen clearly is one of the most traded currencies, you know, in the world. If we get a swing on that, that's going to clearly add to higher risk premiums. And like I said, that's going to test how financial market conditions globally react. And potentially, like I said, given the link, you could perhaps start to shave at least a few, you know, a few tenths here and there, and then maybe add on, exacerbate the situation.
And your thoughts, Ira, on the yen?
First of all, I'm one who believes that the yen, and the book I was holding up for Tom was The Princes of the Yen, written by Richard Werner years ago, but I pay very close attention as a currency trader since the mid-70s, as well as a bond trader. The yen is a critical currency. And I wonder, when I see the weakness of the yen, and yes, I think there's, between the MOF and the BOJ, and others, what, you know, I've wondered for quite a while as we're reshoring out of China, quote unquote, that whether you, part of the policy of the U.S. was to move stuff out of China, that if you kept the yen weak, it would be an incentive, of course, for chip makers and others to move where Japan had been hollowed out with the very, at the 80, 85, 90, 100 yen to the dollar. That the move was, well, make Japan more, because they're a much more reliable supply, that they could, everybody could live with a weak yen. I look at euro yen, which to me is far more important. You know, we made, yesterday we were up at 161. Where are we at right now? We're at 159 and a half. So it's corrected back quite a bit. but the world was looking at, and where they would maybe put some pressure on the yen, upward pressure, and say, you know, hey, you know, you're gonna howl out everybody else now. I look at the settlement, and while I applaud what Sean Fain did, because I'm a believer that private sector unions should get what they can while they can. Again, I'm not saying that about public sector unions, private sector unions, and he did a good job. But the biggest issue for the automakers in the U.S. is they have to compete with Japan in the auto world at 150, you know, at 150, 151 yen to the dollar, very cheap. The weakest yen we've seen in 33 years. And to me, it spells danger. And then you have the United States pushing Japan to increase its defense expenditure, which will aid Japan's move into the defense business. And Japan is very good at engineering things. And at a weak yen like that, they will get very aggressive at some point if they really ramp up their defense industries to be a competitive force on the global scene. Because again, the yen is, to me, far too weak. And it affects, you see it in one of the most interesting charts to me. And I look at charts for directional purposes and risk purposes, of course, is the yen yuan chart. It's locked in between 19 yen to a yuan to 21. And this is a very critical area because this takes us back into the when Clinton went to Beijing, Bill Clinton, in June of 1998. And it was the US government, the US Treasury, who actually moved at the behest of the Chinese, as Bill Clinton was going to Beijing, not stopping in Japan, which the Japanese have never forgiven him, but the United States intervened to sell dollar yen, meaning to buy yen. And it caught the market way off. And why did they do it? Because the Chinese were complaining that the yen was too weak and was impeding upon some of their desires. So I think we're back into this throes now. And that people, the Europeans, I don't know what they're thinking about. The yen at 160 euro makes the Japanese auto sector versus the Germans, which they compete head on globally. If I'm going looking for a car in the United States, I'm not even thinking German. My pricing power, my ability to negotiate is much more in the Japanese auto sector. Now that the supply chains have been reestablished and refilled, I have much greater negotiating power than I do with the Germans, but that's a global phenomenon. Now we also have, of course, the Chinese, who are now, what, the largest exporter of autos, or the second, maybe after Japan. So there are those movements there. So I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the Bank of Japan, and yeah, you know what, Ueda, to me, was a terrible appointee. I thought it to begin with. We didn't need another MIT professor. I'm sorry, Tom, if you're out of MIT, but we didn't need an MIT PhD to run another central bank. Their history has been kind of weak, if you ask me, and his ties to the G30, because I'm not a fan of the G30. I think it has far too much influence on the global scene and are held accountable to nobody. So I have my issues, and I think he was a very poor appointee. Kuroda was Kuroda, but I agree with you. I think that there is things going on in Japan between the BOJ and the MOF and the United States. I think the United States has to be involved in this discussion, or let me expand that, the G7, for whatever it's worth. But it's keeping the yen too low.
Well, I want to chime in on that, you know, just 1 second. Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the crucial aspects behind the weakness of the yen is the fact that the stars are aligned to some extent for them to accommodate that weakness, right? Because at one point in time, inflation was too low, right? Yes. Growth was too weak, and partially because, a good part of that is because of structural impediments in Japan. So they need a weak yen to spur things on. So I think that, you know, that's where I think that they accommodated that. And I think part of the bigger picture behind all this is the fact that structural growth in Japan is not going to improve anytime soon. I mean, it's going to be sub 1%. And despite the bounce this year in Japanese growth, next year growth is going to come back down, right? And that's why I think that, you know, their hesitation in terms of a tightening, you know, too much or too soon. And that's why they have always been trying to manage. So my bone with them, I guess, is the fact that I think they're managing too much, managing policy too much to a certain extent, driving out liquidity, you know, to a point whereby everything becomes artificially priced. And I think that at least from that aspect, I think they need to be mindful, you know, and where is the line? I guess, you know, that is very much dictated by what the growth aspects, you know, structurally. And I think that comes back to the point which I want to maybe expand a bit, because you, Ira, talked about China and the US. And I think the one of the things that, again, you know, with all the talk about the US, China, disagreements and whatnot, the contention there, I think ultimately, again, you know, Chinese structural growth, trend growth, I mean, trend growth in China, I think is moving toward 4 to 5%, right? So they have growth around 5% target for this year. I think they're going to have quite a bit of challenges without, you know, I mean, without any policy support, I don't think they're going to meet that target. So they need additional policy support. I think you are, you know, you have heard some of that, you know, in recent days, and I think they're going to load up further on the policy support, you know, in order to achieve the around 5% target. But ultimately, structural growth in China, as you go further out next year and the year beyond, is going to move toward 4 to 5%. So, you know, and they have to recognize that. And what are the things they can do in order to address or offset some of the structural slowdown in China? I think that's the bigger question that I'm trying to contend with. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a final question. Those are great points. And given those considerations, Tom, what are your views on the investment environment in terms of asset classes that would make sense today?
Yeah. Well, I think that you know, one of the things you know, to really consider is the fact that I think we have to start with what are the macro assumptions behind the views on investment strategy, right? And I think that given what I've laid out so far, I mean my baseline view is that I think growth you know, is likely to soften as you get into next year, right? And I think that there is, you know, the odds incrementally will rise for the Fed to eventually shift on where they are now. And this is subject to what financial market conditions, you know, are, whether they're going to pull that forward or pull that back. So if you have that backdrop, you know, where longer term yields are at this juncture, I think there is room to at least tactically position for some lower yields down the road. But at the same time, I think you want to hedge that with, you know, the shorter end of the curve, right? You don't want to be exposed just to the longer end and thinking that maybe if the Fed turns long, you know, growth starts to soften, longer term yields, you know, start to come down and whatnot. But that might come only in the latter part. So at least in the meantime, you want to at least try to nick some of the income from the shorter end, because rates are going to stay, you know, at least elevated, at least for now, at least for the next 6 months or thereabouts, right? So I think you want to at least play the curve. So that's one aspect of it. For equities, I think you want to incrementally shift to the bigger caps. Maybe even position, you know, toward the more defensive sectors, you know, just in, you know, because the recession call, but incidentally, has been rolled forward right? Quite a fair bit. I think that one of the reasons for that is the fact that the emphasis on one or two indicators, I think that has always been the issue. So you want to look at the whole, string of indicators. And what I do is I look at it, really a whole bunch of indicators on a very short term, on a weekly basis, which I call the weekly recession odds. I mean, and then look at it from the perspective of roughly coincident. I think, if you look at that from an economic standpoint, also from a financial standpoint, I think the recession risk, it's not low, but it's still fairly elevated, maybe around 50%, maybe still a coin flip, you know, in terms of the contemporary odds or roughly coincident odds of a recession in the US. But if you strip out the financial sector, you just look at the data, the odds are decidedly below 50%. But I think those odds, you know, if you consider the financial aspect, and like I said, the theme here is that the financial angle is key to the whole debate, right? And if you bring that in, I think that you have to eventually position for some higher recession risk as you get into next year. And if you believe, you know, that's the risk as you get into next year, then I think that you have to somehow position, for some sectors that potentially could protect you from some potential downturn in 2024, latter part 2024 into 2025, perhaps.
Okay, great. And your final thoughts, Ira, and on the investment environment, just final words?
Well, I think there's so many, we're in a great period, an increased great period of all types of volatility. I agree with Tom totally on the yield curve. I've been very in favor of being long the short end. I've advised people for the last, in a lot of these podcasts, ladder up your T-bills and stay out of the coupon market, because there's just too much uncertainty as to how this plays out. And because the central banks broke over these last 13 years, 14 years, the signaling mechanism of global bond markets. How do you price anything? I mean, we had 18 trillion of sovereign debt priced at nominal negative yields. It's mind-boggling. So coming out of this, how can you really price anything? Because you have residual effects, as we saw with Silicon Valley, as we saw with, more importantly to me, with First Republic, with Signature, and there's more to come. I can look at the price of bank stocks, especially in the United States across the board. And there, as Chris Whalen has talked about far better than anybody else, there's a lot of cracks underneath that structure. And we have to pay attention to them. And the Fed has to be very aware of it. You know, Tom talked about Mary Daly. Well, Mary Daly, to me, and I'm going to pull no punches, is a withering idiot, because she had the person from Silicon Valley on the board of the San Francisco Fed. Well, what did they have meetings for? What were you talking about? If you have the CEO, the chairman of the bank, and you don't know what's going on, you really have some severe problems. You're worried about things that you are. So those cracks in the structures, the bank stock prices tell me. So I like, as I look around the world, if I'm right about certain shifts, I'm looking at Asian banks. And, you know, my favorite bank right now, and Singapore has some great banks. You know, Louis Gavay has been on it, and Mark Faber has been on it. But I look at Mitsubishi Tokyo, which has been dead money for so long. I mean, it's literally on the table. It needs a defibrillator. But I think that because of what some of the structural changes that are taking place in Japan, and because most people don't realize this, Mitsubishi Tokyo owns 23% of Morgan Stanley. That's a very powerful outlet. So I'm just looking at it. I don't tout stocks. I discuss them from what I see. If my global macro view is right, they're sitting in a pretty good seat. They pay you better than a JGB. I think they're paying about 2.7 right now because the stock's gone up in dividend. And I think you're going to see that increase soon because they are making money. Right now, Morgan Stanley's a drag on them. You know, when we think about Morgan Stanley and you want to look at the U.S. banking sector, you know, 4 months ago, Morgan Stanley was a $95 stock. I think it's down to 69 or 70. So that's been, and they own 23% of it. It was one of the better things they did in 2008, 2009, when Morgan Stanley had to go hat in hand, you know, begging for money. And Tokyo Mitsubishi, just like Nora Chukin and other, the postal, were in really good positions to lend to the United States and European companies. And they were able, in a Buffett type of way, to pick up nice assets. So, you know, I'm looking at that, and that will tell me where the, what types of sea changes are taking place. But I, to me, I look over the next 6 months, maybe a year, because the, don't forget, we're going to do a presidential election. And we know that politics are going to work their way through here. We see it right now. So lots of things. I'd like to come back and have further talks with Tom. We didn't cover enough. I could see, because we want to get to Europe. I know Europe is so, the ECB and its role, I mean, it's all tied together, because every time you read a central bank statement, like the Japanese statement the other night when they had their meeting, prior to that, they're all written by the same person. I begin to think that they just go on AI chat and write their statements, because they're all so similar. So they're all, basically what they're telling you, they're all caught in the same bind. But I'm really more fascinated when we come to Europe, and I'll leave off with this, that we look to see what Europe is going to do with the interest on excess reserves, and the fact that this, on Monday, the Swiss went the same route. So there are movements about this, because the cost of funding these QE programs, and Japan has it too, but as Tom rightly talked about, Japan's in, it was in a different situation, because Japan is the only one who had actual deflation. The others tried to create a forward guidance program based on the fear of deflation. And I understand that with Bernanke, because Bernanke's all his academic work and his work on Japan in the 90s and early aughts was really good, but his work was on the depression in the US and its impact. So the fear was deflation, but the fear of deflation that never came, and I know the counterfactual, I don't care about the counterfactual, but it never came, and it put us in, and it put the central banks in a very difficult situation because of that. Japan had actual deflation. So when they talk about the widow maker of the JGBs, everybody wanted to get short the JGBs because the debt was growing, but Japan and the Japanese market, I'll restate it again, when all that was going on, the JGB market was 97% domestically owned. So even if you bought a JGB with a coupon of 50 basis points and you had actual deflation of 1.5%, you had a real return of 2%. That was totally opposite between Europe and the United States, which has left some things that we're really trying to still work through and understand. But I'll leave there and leave our next discussion, hopefully soon, off to Europe.
Yeah, lots of other issues we wanted to discuss. Tom, if it's okay, we can continue the discussion for another podcast, if that's okay with you. Sorry, we're just coming up to a time constraint, but...
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that just very quickly, I just want to mention the fact that, you know, I think the European discussion would be going to be fascinating. You know, I think that's going to bring in the geopolitical angle to the whole debate. And also, not only that, there is also the lingering COVID effect in Europe. I think it seems to be affecting the Europeans more, you know, from that angle. So I think that there is some structural issues there that we need to address. So definitely, I think there, you know, we should come back for an additional session. Look forward to that.
Great. Thank you so much, Tom and Ira.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Ira.
Thanks, Richard. Take care. Yeah.
Bye.
Okay. Thanks.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.